The Senate Committee of Veterans Emergency Preparedness will come to order. Madam Vice Chair, if you would, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Governor Brown yesterday issued a proclamation. Basically, it's Welcome Home Vietnam Veterans, and because I was active in the Vietnam War, shuttling my Vietnam veteran or GIs from Saigon or Cameron Bay to their R&R, wherever that might be, I really wanted to read this proclamation.
Okay.
Do you have a question, Senator? And this is issued by Governor Brown. Whereas May 7th, 2015 represents the 40th anniversary of the end of the Vietnam era for American military members, and the Vietnam War was from 1961 to 1975 and involved North Vietnam and the Viet Cong in conflict with the United States and South Vietnam. And in 1965, there were 80,000 United States troops in Vietnam, and by 1969, a peak of approximately 543,000 troops was reached in 1969, and 1970 were the years that I was flying in and out. More thousands of brave Americans served our country in this conflict with courage, honor, and valor. And more than 58,000 individuals, including 801 Oregonians, six of them from Gresham High School, which I attended, made the ultimate sacrifice in Vietnam. And thousands more were wounded in combat or missing in action. And upon their return home, members of the United States Armed Forces who served bravely and faithfully for the U.S. during the Vietnam War were caught in the midst of a public debate about the involvement of America in that war, and the 40th anniversary presents the opportunity to honor and thank our Vietnam veterans for their brave, courageous military service and sacrifice. Now, therefore, Kate Brown, Governor of Oregon, hereby proclaims March 30th, 2015, which was yesterday, to be Welcome Home Vietnam Veterans Day in Oregon, and encourage all Oregonians to join in this observance. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to all of the Vietnam veterans who served. Colleagues, members of the public's audience, today's calendar is rather lengthy. We have a series of two short hearings, public hearings, in which bills that will not be moving forward, and then we have three or four quick work sessions we're going to work through. So if you're looking at your agenda, colleagues and members of the public, we're going to start at SB 92 on the agenda and move fairly quickly through 92, 97, 408, 251, 252, and 253. And if members of the public are here to testify on other bills, if you just bear with us as we complete some procedural issues. At this point, we're going to open a public hearing on SB 92. Council, if you would, please. And Mr. Sansui and Ms. Saperstein, if you please, still, would you please come up?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 92 requires school districts collect and submit data about children of military families as specified annually to the Board of Education, declares emergency effective on passage. This measure was previously heard on March the 10th, and Mr. Chair, I believe you asked the parties to get together and have a discussion before they came back for a further hearing.
Right. And members of the committee, members of the public, what the chair believes is that as we last session we passed the military compact, we believe that this is within the purview of the military compact. We're going to press them from the committee chair's perspective as the compact gets put together to make sure that the functions that were originally outlined in SB 92 in fact fall under the compact. If they do not, unless I'm relieved by the presiding officer, we'll take this issue up in February and make it so. With that, that's what we're going to do. Mr. Sansui, either one of you have a comment to make or no?
Mr. Chair and committee, thank you. We're great with that. I definitely will be following it very closely for the same reasons you just articulated. I believe it can be done through the compact, so thank you.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Lori Satinspiel, the Oregon School Boards Association, and we too agree. And thank you for every one of you meeting with me and to talk the issue through to be sure that we're not doing undue burden on districts. Let's collect data. That's what we need in one fell swoop and not here and there and patchwork it together. I'll be happy to answer any more questions.
Questions, members? Okay, colleagues, we're going to allow them to reach back to us before the February session if there's a problem, and they can get together with council if this doesn't work out. Thank you. With that, we'll close the public hearing, SB 92. Open a public hearing on SB 92.
Yes.
We're going to open a public hearing on SB 97. Council, if you would, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 97, also previously heard on March the 10th, again briefly on March the 17th, requires the Department of Human Services and Oregon Health Authority reinstate home and community-based services for eligible children temporarily removed from the state due to the parent's military service, as specified. And I believe, again, this is the chair gave instructions, and the parties may have reached some sort of resolution for via rulemaking. We received an exhibit that's posted on OLIS from the folks at the Department of Human Services with proposed rules that I think Mr. Sansucci has reviewed.
And again, members for the committee, I'm going to give Mr. Sansucci a minute here. The intent here is we believe, again, this can be accomplished by rule. If it does not successfully get accomplished by rule, then this bill will be back before us again in the short February session. Mr. Sansucci, if you would, please.
Mr. Chair and committee, for the record, my name is Mark Sansucci, Department of Defense, State Liaison for the Northwest. Yes, I did work with Anna Lansky and reviewed the rules, was satisfied with the rules. I was not aware that it was going to circumvent the bill, but I can continue to follow up on that with the committee's better judgment here.
Thank you, Mr. Senator, and I would ask that you do follow up. If they don't do it and it doesn't make immediate progress, then we will reintroduce
this
bill, and we will invite them to do it whether they like it or not.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair. Mm-hmm. With any other comments, Commissioner? With that, we're going to close the public hearing on SB 97. We're going to open a work session on SB 408. Council, if you would, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 408 appropriates general fund dollars to the Oregon Military Department for purposes of the Military Museum. It declares an emergency as effective July 1st, 2015. This was previously heard on the 3rd of February. Dash-1 amendment has been received that appropriates, fills in the blank for the appropriation in the amount of $1 million and deletes the section that legislates salary. There's no revenue impact on the Dash-1, and there is a fiscal impact, of course. There's also a subsequent referral to Ways and Means because of the appropriation.
Thank you.
Chair Boquist, I move to adopt the Dash-1 amendments to Senate Bill 408, dated 3/19/2015.
Madam Vice Chair Monis Anderson moves to adopt the Dash-1 amendments to SB 408, dated 3/19/2015. Is there any discussion?
Just a comment. I know the proponents are here, and I want to make sure that they realize that this figure could change in ways and means. It's a real issue. Ways and Means has a problem, but we would like to get it down there to see, at least get it down there.
Okay. And I would follow up that I would encourage them to reach out to the Ways and Means Minister to proceed. We need to get something downstairs, and we need to have a placeholder, and we need to have unanimity on the placeholder. With that, is there any further discussion on the Dash-1 amendments? Do I see any opposition to the Dash-1 amendments? So ordered.
Chair Boquist, I move Senate Bill 408 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Madam Vice Chair Monis Anderson moves that SB 408 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that by prior reference it be sent to the Committee on Ways and Means. Any discussion? Seeing no discussion. Any opposition? So ordered. I hope we can do better downstairs in Ways and Means, but we need to move the process along. With that, we're going to close the work session on SB 408, and we're going to open a work session on SB 251. Council, if you would, please, tell us what we're doing.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 251 was previously heard on March 24th. It expands the authority of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs to act without bond as fiduciary for veterans' benefits and receive payment of Social Security and Supplemental Security Income benefits on behalf of qualifying veterans and their dependents. Declares emergency effective on passage. There's no revenue impact, no fiscal impact. It's one of the three ODVA bills on for work session today.
Oh, Chair Boquist, I move Senate Bill 251 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Madam Vice Chair Monis Anderson moves SB 251 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, is there any opposition? If not, so ordered. I'll carry it. With that, we're going to close the work session on 408 and open a work session on SB 252.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 252, the second of the ODVA bills that's up today, previously heard on March 24th, exempts the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs from foreclosure mediation that's required of traditional lenders on home loans that they administer, and exempts them from the foreclosure notice requirements, on home loans it administers. The dash one, which was previously heard, removes the exemption from foreclosure notice. They already, the department complies with notice requirements, so that the bill only exempts them from the mediation process because their rules already require it. There's no revenue impact on the dash one and no fiscal impact.
Chair Bocos, I move to adopt the dash one amendments, is that correct? To Senate Bill 252, dated 3/12/2015.
Madam Vice Chair, Monasenator moves to adopt the dash one amendments to SB 252, dated 3/12/2015. Is there any discussion? Seeing no, is there any opposition? Not so ordered.
Chair Bocos, I move Senate Bill 252 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Madam Vice Chair, Monasenator moves SB 252 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussions, members? Any opposition? So ordered. Madam Vice Chair, if you'd be kind enough to carry the bill.
Okay.
And with that, I'm going to close the work session on SB 252 and open a work session on SB 253.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 253, previously heard on March 24th, makes veterans and service members personally identifiable information exempt from disclosure pursuant to a public records request when it's obtained and kept by the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs in the due course of its functions. There is a dash one amendment that replaces some open-ended language at the end of the measure, referencing protected information and permitting the department to make rules to determine what would be protected. It replaces that open-ended reference and provides a list of the specific information that will be exempt, and that was at the recommendation of the Department of Justice. The dash one amendment has no revenue impact and no fiscal impact.
Chair Boquist, I move to adopt the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 253, dated 3/25/2015.
Madam Vice Chair, Monasenator moves to adopt the dash one amendments to SB 253, dated 3/25/2015. Is there discussion? Is there opposition? If not, so ordered. Madam Vice Chair.
Chair Bocos, I move Senate Bill 253 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Madam Vice Chair, Monasenator moves SB 253 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? Seeing none, so ordered. Senator Olson, if you would, please.
Yes, I'm next.
You're next. Senator Courtney is after that. With that, we're going to close the work session on SB 253. Okay, colleagues and members of the public, you have the agenda before it, which has a series of public hearings, and then there are individuals that I believe want to put information into the record in regards to 408, I see here, which will do that at, towards the end of the meeting to ensure we have time for everybody else. So we'll go back and get everything back in order. With that, I'm going to open. Do you want to, is there two of these you want to do simultaneously?
They are the same content.
717. Okay, what we're going to do, colleagues, members of the public, we're going to open a public hearing on SCR 7 and SB 717. Council, if you would, please.
Mr. Chair.
And
members on the committee.
Mr. Pelham, if you want to start, if you want to come on up, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, SCR 7 and Senate Bill 717 accomplished the same end, memorializing Army Specialist John Alexander Pelham, who was killed in action just last year, 2014.
Sir, I think we've met.
We have. We met at a funeral for another fallen.
That's correct.
Yes, sir.
Well, you have our attention.
I am Wendell Pelham. I live in Portland, Oregon. My son, John Alexander Pelham, was killed. The 12th of February, 2014. He was 22 years old. He was a special forces operator, specialist in intelligence gathering. He was killed in a blue-on-green incident in a forward operating base. John's career was to be full military. That was his goal in life. The Fallen Heroes Highway Program is a wonderful program. We are grateful that the state adopted it for our police officers and law enforcement officers, and then adopted it for the fallen soldiers and the fallen service members. The process in the past has been that when a family has a fallen service member, they get to wait until the next legislative session before that sign can be approved and worked through with ODOT, and then the sign built, and then the sign erected in a spot determined by the family and ODOT. Senator Olson's bill helps move that forward to now with an emergency, I don't know the correct language, amendment clause action, so that as a service member is killed in action, the family can get with ODOT, move that process along faster, and have the signs generated quickly and then put up so that the family members have an opportunity to see that sign recognizing the sacrifice of their loved one. The process to this point for the Pelham family has been just a little bit muddied in that we've had to have multiple conversations with ODOT, and of course those of us who are civilians don't understand traffic. We don't understand flows. We don't understand signage. So when ODOT comes back and says, sorry, we can't put your sign up where you want it, we don't understand that. And so I'm grateful that ODOT has been very helpful, and now we have come to a resolution, and we're gonna put a sign at the intersection of Walker Road and Roxbury Avenue in Portland. And it's right off of Highway 217. We just moved, less than two blocks from that location. So John Alexander Pelham spent the bulk of his young life living in that neighborhood. So we think it's a wonderful place for the sign to be. Really what I want to talk about at this point is the sign program with the new attachments, if you will, the new changes, the emergency part to it, allows families to move forward in their grieving process faster. Won't change the fact that we don't have our child or our husband or our wife. Doesn't change any of that. The fact of the matter is nothing will change that. Having the sign and the ability to get the sign erected in a timely manner just helps the family and the community at large recognize the sacrifice that the soldier made or the service member made and that the family's made. Hence, Gold Star families. We're appreciative of what the Senate's doing and the House will be doing to see that this moves forward faster, because I think as Oregonians, we really do want to recognize those who serve us and then pay the ultimate sacrifice with their lives. And that's what we're after as a family. So thank you very much for all you're doing.
Thank you.
Madam Vice Chair?
Thank you.
Senator Olson?
And you and I have had that discussion before, because I am lucky not to have lost one of my six children, but having called people like your wife, myself, I feel your pain. Thank you. And how the committee generally works is that we hear it 1 week and we schedule it for work session the next week. And seeing that there is no opposition up here, both of these bills will be scheduled for work session next Tuesday. And you don't need to be here. We will pass them out, and we'll see if either Senator Olson or Senator Steyer Hayward wants to carry one of those two bills on your behalf.
Thank you very much.
We appreciate, again, and understand your sacrifice.
Thank you. Thank you.
Is there anyone else that wants to testify on SCR 7 or SB 717? If not, we're going to close the public hearings on SCR 7 and SB 17, and we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2763, if you would please, counsel.
These are substantially similar.
Okay, I stand corrected. We're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2763 and Senate Bill 531 at the same time.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2763 comes over from the House side and is substantially similar to a Senate Bill 531, so they were scheduled at the same time today. They both allow public employers to compensate deployed employees. It stipulates the amounts shall not exceed the base salary on the date of the deployment, and declares emergency effective on passage. They both are substantially similar. As I said, the House bill came over with a House committee vote and a floor vote that were both unanimous.
Okay, Sheriff Roberts, Mr. Griffin, and Mr. Hitchcock? I am right. It's the sheriff. I thought. I didn't even look up. I saw that. I said, that's got to be the sheriff. I know who that is. Sheriff, since you're the ranking member, I'll let you lead.
Okay. Well, good afternoon, Chair Boquist and members of the committee. For the record, my name's Craig Roberts. I'm the sheriff of Clackamas County. I'm here with citizens, other veterans, and folks from our office here in support of Senate Bill 531, and I urge your support on that as well. This issue is really important to me personally because I've seen firsthand the impact that military deployment can have on our employees and their families. At the Sheriff's Office, we're very fortunate to employ many veterans as citizen soldiers who continue to serve our country, National Guard and Reserves. I've spoken at length with many of our deputies that have been deployed and returned home, that have served overseas. And each time I sit down and talk with them about the challenges, both financially, physically, emotionally, they're clearly making a huge sacrifice for our country. And some things that I looked at internally within our office is creating a military support program, and there are a lot of things that we've been able to do within our organization, partnering with the VA, Veterans of Foreign Wars, Three River Post 1324, and creating ways to help support our folks while they're deployed overseas, such as health care for their children, birthdays, helping them reacclimate when they get back into the country. But there's some things that we just are do not have the ability to do, and that is why I'm here to talk about Senate Bill 531. And what 531 does is it's able to create a unfunded mandate for agencies that have the option bring their deployed veterans up to their equivalent to what their pay was when they worked at the sheriff's office. You're going to hear from Deputy Mark Griffith the financial impact that it had on him and his family. And I think what's important to understand is that this is done in the private sector, and that other companies such as FLIR and other businesses in the state of Oregon help compensate for that loss in pay while they're deployed. So I can tell you, speaking on behalf of myself and our organization, I can tell you that we already have money in our budget set aside for deputies that are deployed to Iraq or Afghanistan. So it creates no additional financial burden to cover the gap that these soldiers suffer while they're deployed. And furthermore, I believe it's simply the right thing to do, that we can never do enough for our soldiers. So I would like at this time to turn it over to Deputy Mark Griffith, who helped bring this issue forward.
Thanks, Sheriff. Good afternoon, Chair Boquist and members of the committee. My name's Deputy Mark Griffith, for the record. I work for the Clackamas County Sheriff's Office. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak with you today. I was on active duty from 2008 to 2009 in Kirkuk, Iraq, specifically forward operating base warrior. I experienced the same thing as everybody else does, fear, adrenaline, excitement, anxiety, pride, and so on. My deployment created a real hardship for my family. To begin with, it meant changing the health insurance provided from the sheriff's office to the TRICARE program. This posed a serious challenge, as it meant changing doctors and much higher out-of-pocket costs. Fortunately for the currently deployed, Sheriff Roberts worked with the Board of County, Clackamas County Commissioners to allow them to retain the existing coverage while they're deployed. Another critical impact was being deployed meant a huge cut in my pay. My wife and I literally sold several belongings so my family could get by while I was away. For example, my wife sold my Jeep and my boat, I love that boat, to help offset the drop in pay. If she had not done this, she wouldn't have been able to pay our bills. The drop in pay was significant for us and could be even more significant to others of lesser rank. The loss in pay can be as much as 50% reduction in pay or more. For my family, it was a nightmare. If you can imagine for a moment, the wife of a husband, or wife or husband of an airman, soldier, marine, or sailor at the home dealing with their family all alone. They're busy taking care of all the family's needs, as well as the constant worry someone's going to knock on their door and let them know that their loved one's been killed in action. This stress is compounded as they learn to make ends meet. It requires a lot of work since they still have the same bills, but they've got half the money to pay it with. Their children must eat, bills have to be paid, which prior to deployment was much more manageable. While a loved one is deployed, inevitably something will break, the stove, a leaky pipe, a family car, or one of a million other things that always seem to go wrong. These are just a few of the examples of a story repeated over and over again all over Oregon for those of us in the public sector. The sheriff and other members of our organization did their best to support me, but current Oregon state law prevents public sector employers from making up the difference in pay when the employee is deployed on active duty. Therefore, on my behalf and my family and the countless other families like us, I urge you to pass House Bill 2763 and Senate Bill 531.
Thank you, Mr. Hancock.
I'm Dan Hitchcock. Live in Canby. I'm a retired major general. I came up through the Army Reserve. I also work for the Chief Army Reserve as an ambassador in the state of Oregon. And I volunteer with the employer support of the Guard and Reserve as the vice chair of operations. We have about 90 volunteers throughout the state, like myself, that work with employers. And part of our role and responsibility is to try to find jobs for the Guard and Reservists, either when they return from deployment, or perhaps if they're trying to get into the Guard or Reserve and need a job. We work with a number of employers that offer jobs, and they're looking for the quality of people that come out of the military and what they bring to their organization. And because of this, I would support both of these bills and urge you to please consider them and pass them. Thank you.
Thank you. Before question, and Council, correct me if I'm wrong here, but I think 531 and 2763 are not alike, but are actually identical bills, aren't they?
I believe so, Mr. Chair.
And 2763 came across the House unanimously?
That's correct, sir.
Okay. Thank you. Gentlemen, thank you for your service. And Sheriff, thank you for bringing this forward. I appreciate that. If you'll note, 2763 has passed 60-0 out of the House to this side. If the bill is to go forward, and I don't particularly know why it would not, would you be amenable to allowing us to, for a better word in our terms, do away with 531 and simply pass 2763, which is the identical House bill that came across 60-0?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Madam Vice Chair, any questions?
Now, this is not mandatory. This just allows you to be able to do that. So it's not putting any undue strain on any municipality, correct?
No. As it stands now, it says we may not. Wow. And it also, the law allows us to continue health care coverage, which is where we moved. And then this would not put a burden on somebody who a particular public entity did not want to do it. They would not have to. It would give them literally the option.
Thank you for bringing it forward.
Senator Olson, questions?
Yes. Sheriff Roberts, thank you for coming. Deputy, thank you also for your service. In general, I'm remiss not to mention you since you live in my town. You have planned in your budget to allow for these. Do you know of other entities that would also do that same type of planning, that they would allow, you know, have their resources available and a deputy leaves, and they would have that budget available to them, that this is the budget money you could use to provide money to your officer?
Yeah. The majority of, particularly I'm speaking on law enforcement, I know that I'm not familiar with education on how they do it, but the majority of law enforcement will have that budgeted. The only reason they might not necessarily have it budgeted is sometimes you can also fill that vacancy with an employee, and that would be the only other option where it might be used. So that is an opportunity.
Follow-up, please.
Deputy Griffiths. When you were deployed, or were you a member of the National Guard, you earned your deputy salary plus the National Guard salary, correct?
While I was deployed?
No, when you were not deployed. Were you in the National Guard?
I was in the National
Guard. So you earned your National Guard salary and your deputy salary at the same time? Don't you get paid for being in the National Guard?
I get paid for being in the National Guard. Generally, I would take 2 unpaid days off from the sheriff's office,
okay.
participate in the National Guard activities, and then come back.
Don't get me wrong. I feel your pain.
Yeah.
I feel your pain. This is good because it does put stress on families. And when you leave and change and you have this insurance problem and resource problem, it's very difficult. And as you said, always waiting for that call. This is a great bill.
Senator Courtney, any questions?
Oh, yeah.
Give me 2 things that jump out at me before closing the public hearing so that we're all in the same track is that I don't think most people, there's an anomaly out there in which people say that, oh, yeah, the military has these great health care benefits. If you are an individual, I suppose, or a family living on Fort Lewis or McCord Lewis, that might be a good thing. But I can personally attest to everybody in the audience, and I'm sure the deputy will tell me, that TRICARE is absolutely terrible insurance.
It's a nightmare.
Completely across the board. If you pay additional and buy the enhanced version, just like you go out and buy off the insurance exchange, then TRICARE is okay. But, I mean, my wife is a military retiree. She retired in 1997, colleagues, and she's had 2 bills of less than $400 total from 1997 to today paid for by TRICARE. 2. That's all they would honor. And so, I mean, not only is there the insurance that you lose, but it's just the same thing if you're a deputy making, and I have no idea what the deputies make out here, but I can tell you right now, but if you're deployed as a sergeant or a staff sergeant, you're probably taking as a deal a 50% cut in your disposable income to be a member of the service and serve the country. So, this bill is, colleagues, it did come across the floor at 60-0, so I'm assuming we're going to pass it in some form, and we'll put it for a work session next week. If there are individuals, I know there's a little bit of minor tweaking or wording that has come up that there might be some discussion about. We need to have that in the next couple of days so that we can schedule House Bill 2763 for next week and then let 5331 just die because there's already a bill out there. Any other comments, colleagues? With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on SB 531 and HB 2763. Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you, Sheriff, for bringing this forward. With that, we're going to open a public hearing on SJM 11. Council, if you would, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, SJM 11 urges Congress to improve the delivery of care to rural veterans. I'll quickly put the background on the record. A high percentage of veterans live in rural areas. The Veterans Health Administration Office will take care of that as well. Rural health was created in 2007, to better serve them, but improvements have been slow and inconsistent. Senate Joint Memorial 11 urges Congress to get behind the mission of the Office of Rural Health and accelerate the pace of improvements, eliminate inefficiencies and barriers, and make care accessible to rural veterans.
And I'm assuming you're Mr. Tobiasen?
Yes, sir.
And I think Ellen Lambert is out there, too, somewhere.
Okay.
Alon, please come up. So, if you would, please, sir.
Thank you. Chairman Boquist and distinguished committee members, I am Dick Tobiasen. I'm a retired Army Lieutenant Colonel, and I'm a VA patient for many, many years. I'm a service-connected disabled veteran due to an enemy hand grenade attack in Vietnam 48 years ago, which is pretty embarrassing for an Army pilot. I would like to thank Madam Chair, Vice Chair, for reading the Welcome Home Vietnam Veterans Day proclamation. It's marvelous, and you will be happy to know that we put up 16 Vietnam Veterans Memorial Highway signs on Interstate 84-4, thanking them for their service, and we have 2 in your district.
Great.
Thank you very much for supporting. We also finished the World War II highway under SB 449 several years ago, but I'll be back at the end of the month to testify on HB 203-614 more veterans highways. I am a chairman of the Bend Heroes Foundation, a member of the American Legion, Military Officers Association of America, Military Order of the Purple Heart, Veterans of Foreign Wars, and Vietnam Veterans of America. My address is 22325 White Peaks Drive, Bend, Oregon. It's an honor for me to testify to you in support of Senate Joint Memorial 11. Last week, I testified to your counterpart committee in the House on HJM 14, which relates directly to SJM 11. Later, I would recommend that we integrate these two documents, for time is of the essence for the U.S. Congress to act on behalf of these two documents. I will start out with a provocative statement. No rural civilian will do what rural veterans have to do with the VA: travel long distances for timely and quality health care that is available right where they live.
You can slide back from the mic just a little bit, or push the mic away, because there you go.
Okay.
You're plenty loud, even for a helicopter pilot.
I flew them all, sir, as a test pilot. I would like to summarize two new VA programs that are not part of SJM 11, aimed at allowing veterans to use non-VA health care providers near their homes rather than drive long distances to VA medical facilities. I have to drive 165 miles one way. 8 years ago, I requested the Congress to create a rural veterans health care program, now known as the VA Patient-Centered Community Care Program, PC3. The CEO of our St. Charles health care system in Bend, which is now in four cities, the Central Oregon Health Council and local governments and veterans groups supported this proposal to the Oregon delegation in Washington, D.C. We'd like to believe that that proposal 8 years ago is what led to the PC3 program, and I could explain that in a lot of detail, but let's not do it. So the program, PC3, the objective of that is to get veterans care where they live using local health care providers, which the VA calls non-VA providers, that are under contract to the VA through a third party called TriWest Healthcare Alliance that covers 28 states, including Oregon. The idea is to eliminate wasteful driving, save time for the veterans, and save money for the veterans. The PC3 demonstration program, actually called Project Hero, actually, the VA said, having done this in four rural communities throughout the United States, it actually saved them $25 million. So you can get health care where you live and save the VA money. What's not to like? So, example, where I live in Bend, the Bend VA clinic, called CBOC, treats about 7,500 patients every year. They refer just about that same number to the Portland VA Medical. Some veterans make more than one trip. So they get the care there in the Portland VA Medical Center that they can't do at the clinic, but, of course, the help is right there in town anyhow. So about half of those veterans are transported to the Portland VA Medical Center on the Disabled American Veterans Van, and I drove that for 5 years, and I thought that was a terrible waste of time and money when we're turning our backs on really high-quality health care where we live. So that daily 330-mile round trip, 10 hours for a 30-minute appointment, was not a good idea. So we've wasted a lot of time, and some of the veterans have to come back for a second trip, so we spend 13 hours for 30 minutes. That's an awful waste. There are significant costs to buy and operate and maintain these vans, and they're all over the United States. I think we have 15 in Oregon alone. But this five-year PC3 program is only a temporary program. A year and a half has gone by of it. It's $9.8 billion. We're talking real money, $9.8 billion. And it's been around for a year and a half, and the VA gave almost half of that $9.8 billion to TriWest Healthcare Alliance, which is headquartered in Washington State, to cover BISN 20. I suspect you know what BISN 20 is: Oregon, Washington, Idaho. Those three states are in BISN 20. So we don't know how much of that money's been allocated to anybody. And the program started out as specialty care, maybe hearing, audiology. Now it's primary care, everything. So now everything you want for a veteran's health is in the PC3 program. It's a national program, and it's going to expire in about 3 years. The VA had a wonderful telephone conference call with us across the state of Oregon, and I listened to it all, and when they got through talking, I said, I got five questions about PC3. And when I asked the question, they said, we don't even know what you're talking about. What is PC3? They're all talk about choice. Everybody knows about choice, but no one knows about PC3, and it's real money. So I submitted my questions in writing, and I was later told that the VA will not answer those questions because some of that data they don't even have. I met with the VA undersecretary yesterday with Representative Greg Walden, and he said, we just have a real mess in our hands for data. We really don't know how to answer your question. But I did submit a FOIA request. So to date, we veterans, rural health care providers, the taxpayers, cannot get performance data from the VA to find out how well are we progressing to this wonderful goal that we must achieve within the next 3.5 years. This is a marvelous program. We can't let it die. We got to make it work. We the only game in town. But there's a second half, and that's the VA Choice Card program, which you've heard probably a lot of distress about. The new card resulted from Congress's really unhappiness with what happened with the VA and the scandals at the Phoenix and other medical centers. And from that, they held hearings last summer, and they said, this has got to stop. They came out with a new program and said, yay, barely, here's $15 billion. You got 3 years, $15 billion, and $10 billion is going to go out there to the rural veterans, just like the PC39.8, and you can have $5 billion to spend on your own to hire new doctors. But you only got 3 years. The whole idea is to fix yourself up with $15 billion, and then now you're golden. You got a big empire. You can keep on doing stuff in-house, but forget taking care of those veterans out there with rural providers. That will evaporate. So the scope of this choice program is about the same as PC3. Get your care where you live. Don't drive long distances. Use the same contractor for choice that you did for PC3. So Tri-West Healthcare Alliance has the $4.4 billion plus probably half of the $10 billion from choice. So they're sitting on real money. And we cannot find out how well the program's performing. So now we got $20 billion out across the United States with two contractors to take care of veterans where they live. Most of them are rural. Your SJM 11 document is beautiful with data. I'm a retired test pilot, and I just love numbers and data. So a lot of us are skeptical about the VA's performance, and so is the Congress, and their special hearings coming up with Chairman Miller from the House side and Chairman Isaacson from the Senate side. Yep, the VA is under a lot of pressure to make choice work, even though the president's budget would take money out of choice to go back into the VA for unspecified in-house programs. A lot of us are unhappy. Chairman Miller is very unhappy, and I've sent letters and emails to Congressman Walter and Senator Wyden to say, please don't let that happen. Keep that money out there. Make these programs work. It's going to work. It's just a lot of trips along the way. We're all confused as to what this stuff is. I'm a retired lieutenant colonel. I got a master's degree, and I understand stuff, but a lot of us don't. We were told by the VA sometimes the 30-day waiting time in choice is 30 business days. Some say it's 30 calendar days. We were told the 40 miles is as crow flies. Now we know that nobody drives cars as the crow flies. So the VA is under pressure to get a statute changed to allow them to use 40 miles as you drive. And if they do that, which Chairman Miller promises to do, that doubles the number of rural veterans who will be involved. If we get the distance changed from the nearest VA facility to the nearest VA facility that will give you the care that you need, that will be an enormous change, enormous. If you didn't have the 30-day and the 40-mile restrictions, you're talking a $50 billion program. So what the Congress did says, tell us what it takes, what can you do for $10 billion? They said, oh, make it 40 and make it 30. So now we've got some new laws coming out that are going to change the current standards, and no one knows how many veterans will be treated with the available money. So the VA, to its credit, said on Secretary McDonald said on March 24th that we're open to change the driving distance and the 30-day time frame. So those common sense changes will make a huge difference to rural veterans. So when veterans call to get an appointment through the Choice Program, they get conflicting information from, I can give you anecdotal evidence, but there's a lot of trouble out there when a veteran gets told, you have to meet both criteria. No, you don't have to meet 40 miles and 30 days. You only have to meet one. And so there's confusion as to which criteria you have to meet, and veterans really don't know, and a lot of veterans have given up. In our town in Bend, Oregon, we had a newspaper article chronicle the problems of six of six veterans who had just given up on seeking care from the VA because of the confusion and communications and phone numbers and just the administrative trivia that's not working. A dear friend of mine went to Portland from Bend for 2 days to get dermatology and neurology works, 100% disabled PTSD Marine. And when he went to the VA, they said, first of all, the medication we gave you is the wrong one when you're taking it the wrong time of day. And then, your dermatology work? We can't do that. Let's send you back to Bend where you came from to Dr. Jerry Peters, who's an Air Force colonel. So there's a lot of friction in the system. It's all transitory. I'm convinced it'll all work if we make it work. If you took the $19.8 billion between the two programs and just did some quick analysis, you'd say, and you prorate them to the 8.5 million veterans enrolled in the Choice Card program. I have a Choice Card, but I can't use it. If you prorated it to the 8.5 million veterans out there, you're talking about $2,000 or $3,000 over 2 or 3 years because the program's going to evaporate, so you can't spend the money beyond that period. So it's that. We have 330,000 veterans in Oregon. We're 1.5% of the nation's 22 million veterans. If you took the Choice Card information, you would say that there are probably 120,000 veterans in Oregon that would qualify for Choice. Okay? But we can't find out. We are finding out a little information as to how many veterans are enrolled in Choice, and I have some data here I can submit for the record, but it's not a very big number because the program is just rolled out. It's only 6 months old, and yet the VA is already trying to take money out of it. So that's not. I don't think that's going to happen. I don't think Congress is going to allow that to happen, but the president has asked for that in his budget for next fiscal year.
We have other people with it. Can you summarize, Colonel?
Sure. So if you took these two programs that are temporary, we got to make them work. And what I'd like to see is to take the HGM 14 that I testified on last week. I asked Representative Bueller for that bill. He's a doctor and I'm a veteran. I'd like to take that bill and your bill and put the two together and send them to Congress. You have a couple of fascinating things in your bill. Accelerate the implementation and get Congress involved through the Oregon delegation. I would love to see those two bills put together, sent to Washington, because the clock's running out with Congress to get these fixes. And I think we in Oregon have taken the lead in identifying the problem. Let's get this program fixed and make these programs work and make them permanent, not temporary. Don't let them die, because you're going to raise expectations for rural veterans that they're going to get health care, and then we're back to where we started 5 years ago. Thank you.
Madam, if you would, please.
Chair Boquist and members of the committee, my name is Alon Lambert. I am a Vietnam veteran, Vietnam-era veteran, Navy, and I've been a veterans advocate since 2008, testified numerous times before the committee previously. I am currently the program director for WestCare, which WestCare is a national nonprofit, been around for over 40 years, starting from the present CEO, Dick Steinberg, who is a two-time Vietnam vet medic, down through a lot of the management is veterans, very veteran-oriented. Office of Rural Health, the VA Office of Rural Health, actually gave five agencies in the United States, and only five agencies, money, $2 million apiece for 2 years, to actually work with the rural counties on their health care for veterans and families. So WestCare was awarded one of those grants. It's $2 million for us for 2 years. And the program is actually combines Oregon and Washington. It's a pilot program. At the end of the 2 years, that we'll be testifying before Congress to ask for money to do this across the United States in rural areas. And so it's called the Rural Veterans Coordination Pilot Program. I did give information to, you may have it. And basically, I just want to talk a little bit about what the WestCare program is for the rural health. So in Oregon, the two counties that we are doing this demonstration pilot in is Tillamook County and Umatilla Counties. What we have is we have boots on the ground. So I have what we call navigators, who are very similar to what the National Guard reintegration team members did. And so work with veterans and family members on jobs, education, health care. Our offices even have an emergency food bank in them so that our navigators can assist, again, not just veterans but family members in the issues that they're dealing with. So we have the boots on the ground, but another piece that we have is actually one of our subcontractors is Alliance for Life. And so the Military Helpline is a part of this program. So not only do we have the boots on the ground, but we have the 24/7, 365 coverage. So when our navigator out in Tillamook has a vet come to them, they let them know that we have the phone coverage, same with the come through the phone lines, that they have boots on the ground. So we do have that 24/7 coverage, and we are holding town hall meetings where our idea is that we're going to the vets where they are rather than expecting the vets to come to us. So for an example, in the counties, we are going out to the small towns and taking the as part of this program, we have a veterans benefits specialist who also does the Social Security filing. The SOAR, he's SOAR trained, and so he can do those things. Our navigator will go. We've got housing people. We've got people to cover all local community colleges to go to the veterans and say, not only are we here, but we are here. We can do your application right here, right now. And so we're turning that whole piece on top of its head and not expecting them to come to us. And again, we can serve family members. The vet does not have to come to us. We can serve family members on their own and secondary family members who could be parents, brothers, sisters, aunts, uncles type of thing. So I just wanted to make you aware that the Office of Rural Health is doing something and that the grants, we were very gracious to get one. So any questions?
Thank you very much. Ms. Sullivan, did you want to testify? Well, as you know, Mr. Sullivan's always the one that brings these rural health things forward to the committee and says we need to take care of veterans. So,
for the record, my name is Mike Sullivan. I am the Oregon political director for the Association of Western Pulp and Paper Workers, and I appreciate the two individuals here pushing for health care for rural veterans. This will be the sixth session that I'll be bringing forth a memorial to change how the VA is funded from discretionary spending to permanently funded. And things like these efforts that we're hearing today should only help that effort. I applaud theirs. Thank you.
Vice Chair, questions?
No, this is something I think that has been on our minds for a long time. My very first patient in 1980, about, was a Vietnam vet. We were in rural Virginia, Appalachia area, and he was homeless. I saw him going through garbage, getting things. We didn't have any health care, VA health care around. If he had, he wouldn't have. We immediately, when I went in, there was complaints about a smell. He had maggots actually growing on his legs. He just wasn't, you know, he had post-traumatic stress. He was a Vietnam vet, and there was no one to care for him. So that he was in a rural area, so it isn't just the state of Oregon. We need to make Congress do something. This, whether they do it or not, is I don't know. But once we get them into the VA system, he was taken care of. But we have so many people that just don't have access to the VA, and it needs to change.
Okay. Senator Olson, comments?
No, thank you.
Courtney, comments?
May I add
please.
Something, sir? Senator Olson, you are a member of the VFW?
Yes, ma'am.
I am, sir. So the VFW has done a survey across the United States about this whole mess, and they've come up with an interim report, which I'd like to submit for the record, but it talks about removing the confusion and dialogue between the veterans, the VA, and the veterans, because there's inconsistent communications between the two, and that's why veterans are giving up. The VA said the veterans aren't signing up, that's why we want to take money away. Veterans don't know everything about this program, but I'd like to submit for the record the recommendations that the VFW has made. As an interim report, and there'll be more reports, but I'm grateful that they've done that. Thank you, sir.
And if you'll give it to staff, I'll have it posted on all this, too. And colleagues, we'll take this bill up, SJM 11, next week during the normal session. And as is noted, the House Joint Memorial, it's 14, it's in the other chamber. I'm certain we can coordinate between the clerk and the secretary for the same mailing documents at the same time. With that, colleagues, thank you very much for your service. We're going to close SJM 11, and if there's no dissent, we're going to return to an informational hearing on 408 to take the testimony from earlier. And with that, we're going to open information on 408. And Alicia, James, and is it John? You want to come up? You signed up to put information into the record in regards to the museum. Yeah. And Madam Vice Chair, if you would momentarily, I've got to step out to the restroom while we grab back.
Alicia.
I'm not sure what I should say. I just want to thank you for pushing this forward, and we look forward to working with the Ways and Means Committee in the hopes that maybe we can increase the amount in that. But we're happy with whatever amount you guys push through. Thank you.
Members of the committee, I'm James Thayer, Jr., and if I could just take a couple minutes this morning or this afternoon to offer a couple of personal reflections on the museum and what we're doing. I wish we could put hundreds, if not thousands, of names of men and women of Oregonians on this museum, because there are that many stories that this museum, this place, this educational center will hold to be told to future generations of Oregonians. These stories are important, and they represent for all Oregonians where we have been, who we are, and I hope where we are going as a society and as a state going forward. We need to preserve these stories so that we can strive to be better informed and educated people, to examine what we have done right in the past and also what we have done wrong, with the idea and hope that bringing people together so that we may do better in the future. When we started this endeavor, we started at the grassroots with a modest vision of what might be. That vision, through the contributions of many in ideas, volunteerism, and financial support, has grown into a unique opportunity for the state of Oregon, a vision that all Oregonians will be able to take pride in. We have received financial support from groups and individuals, both large and small, all being vitally important, and we hope to continue to see that support as we pursue our goal. The federal government has also seen the value in this project for the citizens of the state of Oregon, allowing us to begin the construction process and furthering momentum of the project. With that said, the Oregon Military Museum is first and foremost an Oregon museum and learning center. With that in mind, this is why we are here again today, in the hope that the state of Oregon can and will be a meaningful partner going forward to help us all achieve this wonderful and needed place of tribute, remembering, and education for all the people of the state of Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Madam Vice Chair, I'm John Sanford, the Legislative Director for the Historical Outreach Foundation. I'm a disabled combat vet from Iraq and am here to support the Senate Bill 408. Please excuse me. Quick note, we just launched our website for the museum with military.com, which means we are building partnerships in the community. as much as possible to tell the story of our Oregonian veterans. We launched it yesterday with military.com, which has a unique viewership of 10 million viewers a month, meaning that hopefully the stories of all of our Oregonians will be out and told throughout the world. From what we know, this is the largest partnership to tell veteran stories across the United States, and we've also partnered with the Library of Congress to continue on that conversation and to make sure all those stories are then put in the archive at the Library of Congress. So we're moving forward. With that being said, we also have 322,000 veterans in Oregon, and around 70% of them don't have access to benefits. Now, this isn't news, but it's just to point out we have a challenge with reaching out to our veterans. Now, I'm joined with many members of our veterans community to help ensure that we do better in Oregon to reach out and tell the veteran's story here. We have a representative from U.S. Senator Ron Wyden's office who is going to come in. We have our elder of the community, Mr. George Bickford, a 92-year-old naval aviator and the first Top Gun instructor in America. He lives in our communities in Oregon. Alicia Hamill, of course, is our executive director, who's been a member of this community for some time. Jim Thayer of the Thayer family, who the museum is named after. General Hitchcock, of course, here. We're very thankful to have him as to be part of our community. Alon Lambert, one of the best advocates in Oregon, was here to join us. Colonel Brown from the National Black Veterans for America. I just want to make sure I got that right. And representatives of the 1st Marine Division and, of course, some other members of our community. The reason I mention these people is we have assembled representatives from the major military branches, members of the community, and representatives of the veteran service organizations, and we are here to publicly thank you for your support for the Oregon Military Museum. One request we have is to ensure that this bill isn't hijacked in ways and means. It's our fear. That during this unique time, we ensure that all Oregon veterans are remembered, including the 1,000 veterans that are coming home in June. Thank you, Chair and Madam Vice Chair, for your excellent support. We would have not gotten this far, and by any means, without your trailblazing to get to this point. And we look forward to opening up a military museum where we actually remember what veteran service was rather than just thanking them for their service. Thank you.
Chair?
You have the gavel.
Senator Courtney? Senator Olson? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Tom Milligan and is it Leonard Brown?
Mr. Chair, Madam Vice Chair, thank you for having me. My name is Tom Milligan. I'm a Vietnam veteran. I'm a fighter pilot. I served two tours in Vietnam and flew 272 combat missions in jets. I moved here in 1997 with my family. I have a young family. And my three sons went through Oregon public school system. One went on to be a cadet at United States Military Academy, West Point. He served in Afghanistan, and he's presently a first lieutenant platoon leader in the 82nd Airborne Division at Fort Bragg. I have another son at Arizona State who's in Army ROTC, but he also has a full-ride scholarship at ASU, and I have one who's graduating from UNLV. I'm here to support SB 408. Oregon has played a vital role in the history of this United States. We have many, many stories to tell, many, many stories to tell from our veterans and our service members who are serving now and who have served. We need a place in Oregon for those stories to be held and seen and visited. And I support the Oregon Military Museum for that reason. We don't want those stories to be lost. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Madam Vice Chairman, my name is Lieutenant Colonel Brown, and I represent the National Association for Black Veterans. I'm the founder of the organization in November of 2006. We're the only black organization in the state of Oregon. Our national organization is in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and it started back in 1969. I support the Oregon Military Museum because I want to ensure that our story is included. So please help me open the Oregon Military Museum and include us in it. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
The distinguished member of the panel, Madam Assistant Secretary, I'm a member of Colonel Brown's organization. But what I'd like to testify to is that I heard that Governor Brown declared yesterday as a veteran, welcome home Vietnam veterans. I waited for that from the state of Oregon for many years. What I like to do is just put this in mind. You won't see it again unless you see it with me, because I do believe that I stand as the longest serving veteran in Vietnam. I served from 1966 until 1972. So therefore, when we talk about a museum for the state of Oregon reopening, and I see that it was closed in 2009, and we're asking that it be reopened. We support, and we definitely appreciate your support, because we don't want the stories to be forgotten. I don't want to go too long, but what I like to say is that my tours in Vietnam was simply because I was not welcome home. I was not welcome home when I came in 1967 after being there from 1966. And so rather than stay, I went back because I felt more comfortable there than I did here at home. So Vietnam is over. There's a lot of veterans still out there. I'm a service officer. I'm Colonel Brown's service officer, matter of fact, because those veterans don't need to be out there. Those veterans that are here need to be recognized, and so therefore we support and definitely appreciate your support for reopening the museum. Thank you.
Thank you. Any comments?
Thank you for your service.
Thank you very much. Is there anyone else who wants to testify on Senate Bill 408? I'm very excited about the museum. I mean, the plans are really, I think, exciting. It will do so much for our youth education, and it would be the only one in the Northwest, correct? Yes. And it could be a draw and a good, even for tourism for your county, right?
Absolutely.
All right. With that,
we're done for the day, ma'am.
We're done? Okay. Thank you very much for coming. We will close Senate Bill 408, and we are adjourned.